Blog Talk Radio.
Child running wild. Welcome to another episode of Hear No Evil here at blogtalkradio.com. I am your host, Darlene Lewis, and tonight we will have an intellectual conversation with an educator by the name of Dr. Steve Perry, born Stephen Perry. He is an American principal, an author, a coach, a speaker, and philanthropist. And he is known for his many speeches and conferences and education and yada, yada, yada. And he has also written books, Man Up, Nobody Is Coming to Save Us, and Push Has Come to Shove. But I'm going to pick his brain because I thought after writing 9 books, having a TV show, a radio show, doing a tour, volunteering at HandsThatMakeADifference.org, as a youth coordinator, that I was doing a lot. But after reading and seeing all that this man has done and all of the schools that he has opened, I feel like I'm not doing enough. So I need to know what his secret is. I need to know what gives him his passion. And I just want to pick his brain on the education of black children, black and brown children, and all children. But until then, we have a caller calling from an 860 area code. Caller, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, this is Steve Perry.
Dr. Stephen Perry, thank you for calling in. How are you, sir?
I'm having a time of my life. How about you?
I am. Well, I feel like I just said I'm not doing enough. I feel like I need to do more.
I think you're doing your thing.
I'm not doing as good as you, sir. I'm so honored to have you on the show. And I read a little bit about you. I've been following you, but I read a little bit about you, and I was thinking that you were some old man. You know, I don't know why I pictured you as being like this old man that, you know, wanted to give back to society. And then I saw your picture. I said, wait a minute. There's no way in the world this guy is old enough to be doing all of these things. So tell my listening audience, because I'm also televising my TV show simultaneously, which is the first time I've ever even attempted to do this. So I'm so proud that I'm able to do this. And I have no staff with me today. I'm doing everything myself. But I still feel I'm not doing as much as you. Tell me how this all became, how you became to be an educator.
Well, it started because I'm committed to our community. My introduction to what many might call activism was early in life when my mother was on a tenants association in our public housing project. And then seeing the work that she was doing and what she was attempting to do to change the conditions in which we were living. And then, of course, living in those conditions. It didn't take long to realize that this ain't cool. There's got to be another way to live. So from as far back as I can remember, it always seemed like it was my responsibility to do something.
Okay, so you said you grew – where did you grow up, actually?
I grew up in Connecticut, in a place called Middletown, Connecticut.
Okay, so you grew up in a housing project, and I read somewhere that your mom was a teen mom.
She was, yeah, born on my mother's 16th birthday.
You were born on your mom's 16th birthday?
Uh-huh.
Did you just say your mom, so you and your mom have the same birthday?
We do.
Wow.
We do.
Wow.
We
so
yeah.
basically, she like grew up with you. And so was education like pushed on you from her? Like, did she say, get your education, you must get your education?
Not at all, actually, no. It wasn't because she didn't care about it or didn't care about it. It just wasn't the way it went down. She was focused on working and doing what she needed to do. And for me, it was sports. I enjoyed playing sports. And, you know, education was something that I did because the other things that people were doing, I wasn't into. People, a lot of those I was growing up with were into some foolishness, and I didn't want to do what they were doing. So I decided to do the only other thing that I could do, which was to be in school. So it wasn't a big, it wasn't one of those things, once you get this, nobody can take it from you. It wasn't that for me. It wasn't that for me at all, actually. It was just of the options that I had, it was the one that was most reasonable for me.
Well, you're speaking like so modestly because you're a principal and you're a young man, but now you're a CEO, a head of schools. Like,
yeah,
I just can't imagine. Do you not understand? Well, I guess you understand, but I don't think my listening audience understands how hard it is to not only have a school, but to convince parents to allow children to go to your school, be able to fund the school, be able to find teachers that actually want to teach children to learn to become better citizens. It is incredible. So how did you get your first school? Like, how was that experience?
So our first school was five, but the first school started in Hartford, and I had started a not-for-profit organization that worked with kids who are going to be the first in their family to go to college, poor kids. And I was working in other people's schools. And as I worked in other people's schools, what I found was that Black and Latin kids were being done dirty. And more specifically, what was happening was they were being over-identified as special needs. And then those who were not being identified as special needs, they were being played by the teachers and principals and guidance counselors in the school because they were the ones being suspended, disciplined, or expelled the most. And then those who weren't being suspended, disciplined, and expelled, there was another group of kids who were not being granted access to the quality of courses that they needed in order to perform well. So it seemed like I could do at least as bad as they were doing. I had never met anybody who had started a school. I didn't even know you really could start a school. But anything seemed like it was better than what it was that was going on. So we began the process. I put together a team who I believed would help get the school started. That we had a great first meeting. Went really, really well. And then that team never materialized into anything. So I had to go back and get another team, and that team worked really hard to put together the parts that were necessary to get the school up off the ground. So in 2005, we launched our first school.
That's amazing. So you launched your school in 2005. Now, what was the enrollment like? Like, what were the numbers like?
First year, we enrolled 145 kids. We had 1,100 apply.
Wow, that's amazing. So you had to turn down all of those kids. You know, now, when you say you opened up your first school, did you have to charge the parents for the kids to
go
there?
No, it's free. First school is a magnet school. It's free. It's free public school. The other schools are charter schools, also free public schools.
But Dr. Perry, how are you able to offer free education? Like, did you do fundraisers? Did you have donations? Like, how does that work?
So magnet schools and charter schools are publicly funded schools. And what the state does is they put out what's called a request for proposals. So we wrote a proposal. The proposal got accepted, and once you get accepted, you receive the funding from the state to open the school.
Right. Okay. So, wow. So you had to, oh, my God. So you had to pass all of these tests. You had to, I'm quite sure you had to deal with the Department of Health. You had to have the building inspected. You had to probably do a budget for expenses. So all of that goes into the RFP?
It does. And then you have to also have community support. So you can't just write a proposal about how you want to run a school. You have to show how you have the community supporting you in the opening of that school.
Right. Because I've been volunteering since 2015 at a program called HandsThatMakeADifference.org. HandsThatMakesADifference.org is the site, but it's called Hands That Make a Difference, and they're located in Harlem. And whenever you're in New York, please let us know so you can come by and see what they're doing. And we provide after-school services, like tutoring and homework help. And I implemented an anti-violence initiative called Save Our Seeds. And I've been trying so hard to get funding, to get politicians to help us. And so most of the donations that we get come from people, you know, like you said, in the neighborhood. But it has been extremely hard getting support from Harlem. And so you opened up Capital in Harlem. How did you accomplish that?
Well, it began with a call from the community, people in the community recognizing that they needed something different than what they had. And so and then we came in on the humble. I went to Union Housing Projects, which is not far from where we are, went to other places, and just went in, sat down and listened to people, what it was that they had to say about what they wanted, and did everything we can to create the kinds of schools that they said that would matter to them.
And it was just that easy? But then I heard that Sean Puffy Combs came to you and said he wanted to help you some kind of way. Did you already have the school when he came to you, or?
Not the Harlem school. We had a school in Connecticut. And then he said he wanted to open his own school. So we partnered up on a school in Harlem. But the truth is, no one knew except for him and a couple people that he was involved in any way.
Okay, right. So that made it even easier for people to be honest about wanting to see the school succeed, because probably if they knew he was involved, it probably would have went a little different. What do you think?
It could have gone either way. Who knows? It could have gotten better or worse. But we'll never know because no one knew.
So now, you mentioned you had 5 schools.
Yeah, so we have schools that we've opened in Bridgeport, in Hartford, in Harlem, and with 2 in Bridgeport, 1 in Harlem, 1 in Hartford, and then now 1 in the Bronx.
Wow. And the Bronx is predominantly a Spanish-speaking borough. So do you find that the majority of the kids speak Spanish in that school in the Bronx?
No, not at all schools.
Really? Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
So do you feel that charter schools offer more to our youth than regular public schools?
They're necessary. If the other schools were working, there would be no charter schools. The reason why there are charter schools is because our neighborhood schools have failed to educate our children.
So the curriculums are a little different, is that what you're saying? Or are the schools smaller classrooms? Like, how is it different? Because I know when I was looking for schools, when my twins were little, we wanted teachers that understood the needs of children that were special, as far as like brilliant or even a little intellectual, because my twins were very smart. And I noticed that when I tried to put them in a regular public school, they weren't being challenged. So their father decided, well, maybe we should put them in private school. So I wanted them to go to Catholic school because I got kicked out of Catholic school. So I was determined to get my kids to go to Catholic school. And that's what their life ended up being, school to Catholic school. But had there been charter schools around when my twins were little, they're 28 now, but had there been a choice for me to put them in a charter school, I would have chosen a charter school. Because as you said, I don't feel that the public schools are giving the children what they need. I feel they're overcrowded. I feel that the curriculums are antiquated. And I feel that the people don't even care if they really, really succeed at a higher level. I'm a foster parent. I'm a therapeutic foster parent. My foster child was happy to receive a 69. Her guidance counselor was like, well, she passed. She got a 69. I'm like, a 69? You call that passing? Like they don't care about our youth, you know? So I agree with you 100% that public schools are not giving the children what they need. And let me ask you, I know you're a parent. Did you put your kids in public school or charter school?
Well, charter schools are public schools, but my kids have always attended our schools. So so they don't just go to any charter school. They go to our school.
Oh, that's one. See, and that's the brilliance. This is what I'm talking about, Dr. Perry. This is what's needed. More men, more women involved in the education process, putting their children in their schools so you know that your kids are going to learn. We have a caller that just called in from a 315 area code. Thank you for calling in here. No Evil. We are on with the brilliant Dr. Stephen Perry. Who's calling and where are you calling from?
This is Tiffany Real, and I am in Grand Junction, Colorado right now.
Oh, thank you for calling in, Ms. Real. Do you have a question?
Yes. Dr. Perry, I've been following you a long time, and when I think of education and the kings and queens of education, you and Marva Collins is it. And years ago, I saw you when you were a principal and the great things you were doing with the kids. I just think it's great. But my question is, what advice would you give parents who have children who can't attend your schools? What advice would you give them when people want to label them as maybe ADHD, especially our black boys?
Mm.
So, first of all, let me say I am humbled by your words. Sister Marva Collins is a giant among giants, and so to be mentioned in a conversation, not even just a sentence with her, is humbling at best. So thank you. And anything that you've ever seen that's gone really well in the work that we do, I attribute that to our team as a whole. There's nothing that I do by myself that's so great that I would deserve all the credit for that. So I'm very, very fortunate that I'm on a great team. That being said, we have a significant issue throughout the country called racism, and you add to that sexism, and it's the sexism that says that a black boy is inherently dangerous, no matter how young he is. There's a statistic that says that African Americans make up 18% of the kindergartners, yet they make up 48% of all the kindergartners who've been suspended or expelled, and the majority of those are black boys. And you ask yourself the question, why is that so? Well, over 80% of all teachers are white, and about 80% of all of them are women. And so the people who are most likely to determine whether or not your son is or is not doing what it is that they believe he's supposed to do are people who are neither black nor male. And so their interpretation of his behavior is that it seems like there's something wrong with it because it doesn't reflect what their experiences have been, either as while they were growing up as girls or as parents of white children, especially even white boys. So you and your fight are dealing with the same fight that millions of black mothers and mothers who are white who have black sons, or mothers who are Latina who have black sons, but anybody who's raising a child, a boy of color, is struggling with, which is, how do I carve out an academic experience that's fair and loving for my son when I don't have access to a school that's started by black people, for black people in the black community? And that is a challenge. And so I'll do what I can to answer the question, knowing that my answer will be insufficient because you do not control the behaviors of the people who are in control of your child for 6 to 7 hours a day. So it begins with you being involved in school. As a black mother, you're required to be more involved than other mothers, especially a black mother of a son. And what involved means is that they need to see your face up at the school early and often. They need to be aware that he has a mother and his father's in his life. He has a father. He has people who care about him who are not about to let any old foolishness happen. You should also do what you can to work with him to prepare him for the academic experience, which in many cases people think is teaching him how to read, write, and compute, which is true. That's important. But one of the most important things that you can do is to teach him how to talk to you about what he experiences at school. It is all too easy for black boys to be identified, quote unquote, as having special needs. But there is no special need that is so consistently found that it happens to end up in so many black boys. It's not the issue. The people with the special needs, in many cases, are the people who are identifying them, who don't understand them, and who are unwilling to look at their own racism and their own sexism and determine whether or not it is they who are assessing him wrong as opposed to him who is acting wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other part of it is, don't be afraid of the big solution. The big solutions are finding another school for your child than the neighborhood school, going to the Board of Education and fighting for more school choice, and creating, if necessary, with other people, schools for yourselves. My sons have always attended our schools, and I say that because we opened their schools in their lifetime. We didn't have to wait 15, 20 years to open a school. We just put together a team of people who did what we had to do to open our own schools. So I say there are small solutions, which is you being at the school and letting them know that you're not about that foolishness. You're going to make sure that they know that this child belongs to somebody. And then what you're going to do is you're going to do what you can to engage for some of the larger discussions, which is with the Board of Education. And then you go see even to get more school choice, and then you got to fight to consider maybe even put your child in a different school because it's not okay, but it is typical. I wish I could say to you, sis, that your experience is so rare, but if we had this call with 1 million black mothers of black sons, 1 million of them would talk about a time in which their child had been mistreated by someone who they left in charge of him. And that's not cool, not fair.
Well, can I just say that I have three boys. My oldest is 30, my middle is 18, and my youngest is 15. My sons, are doing well, but my middle son, the 18-year-old, he's a freshman at Joseph C. Smith University. But when he was small, they tried to say that he was hyper and active, but I explained, you have a child that spends 5 years practically doing what they want to, and they're full of energy. It may take a minute for them to calm down, as they say. And I never accepted that title. I never had him evaluated. And he was a straight-A student. He's an athlete. He goes to school and he works at UPS. And my youngest son is 15, and in the fall he's going to be a junior in high school and a freshman at DeVry University. So, you know, I agree with you that parents, they need to communicate with the teachers from day one, and they need to do it in front of the children so that they know that it's a team effort. So I thank you for your response.
Thank you, sis.
I want to thank you, Ms. Real, for calling in, and good luck with everything with your guys. And you seem to have done a great job, and thank you for calling in. Dr. Steve Perry, what about a curriculum of inclusion that that focuses on African history pre-Westernized transatlantic slavery? Like, does your charter schools try to give a better historical approach to learning? Because I don't know, for some reason, I feel that a lot of kids fail the school system sometime because they don't see themselves in what they're learning. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah, I do understand. And I know that we're only going to the top of the hour, so I will be brief.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll say this. It isn't so much what children learn as it is who is teaching them. And by who is teaching them, to some degree that means people of color, men when it's a young man, but not solely. It doesn't mean that black kids can only learn from black men. Like, that's silly. What I mean is that it isn't that they learn the foundations of math from its origins on the continent of Africa as much as it is that the person who's teaching them shows them that there's something special in them and makes them feel like they're 10 feet tall and makes them feel like this subject is something that they can learn. And when that who that is teaching them approaches education in that way, what it does is it creates the kind of interest that every student wants. If you were learning from someone who didn't seem like they gave a damn about you, you wouldn't take the time to learn from them because you feel like, if they don't care about me, why do I care about them?
Hmm.
And so it has less to do, it's my experience, it has less to do with a Pan-African approach than it is with a humanist approach, which means you begin with the child in mind. Every child is not going to identify with every kind of curriculum. It's just not the case. But many of us can reflect upon a teacher from our past who inspired us. In some cases, she was as white as a driven snow. In some cases, she taught a subject that we had no interest in. And in some cases, they couldn't have had a more different upbringing than we do. But for that moment in time, they seemed like they cared about us. And they made us seem like we mattered to them. And because of that, and that alone, we wanted to learn what they were teaching. We wanted to buy what they were selling.
You know, that's 100% true, because if it wasn't for my English teacher in 11th grade, I don't think that I would have become a writer. So you just hit on a point that I'm going to take into consideration. And I know that you are such a busy person and you've had a long week. And I know you want to probably go somewhere and close your eyes and relax. So I'm going to let you go. And
well, thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to talk to you. And
yes, and I'm so proud of you. And I'm gonna be picking your brains, if you don't mind, in the future.
Thank you. All right.
Okay.
Well,
thank you
care.
So much. Right. And good luck with everything.
Right. Likewise. Good
that
night.
Was good night. That was Dr. Steve Perry, born Stephen Perry. I want to thank him for calling in. Well, we got a half an hour more to go, guys. And I feel like some Marvin Gaye. What about you? We'll be right back.
Oh, come on. Woo! get it on.
You know how much I love me some Marvin Gaye. Right now, over 5 million people are playing Fortnite. Last month, nearly 240 million people played Candy Crush. And last year, 31 million of us paid $6+ for a new version of Animal Crossing, the mega world of gaming. What draws nearly half of all older Americans and an even larger percentage of those younger than us to play so many games on a phone, computer, or console hooked up to a TV? What makes digital gaming so appealing that it becomes both a daily and lifelong pursuit? Including for a 50-something-year-old like me, actually I'm 60-something, who's been playing since their arcade days in the 1980s. The easy answer is that it's a temporary escape from the pressures of the real world, an essential distraction. Particularly over this past year. And yes, lots of people online say games, they qualify as wonderful diversions. Countless Americans pass some time each day playing Sudoku, Candy Crush, Angry Birds, and other puzzle games on their phones or tablets. Now, if you're a person like me that feel that video games or phone games are a waste of time, you may want to reconsider. I would like to know why creating video games is not a part of the school curriculum. You know, sometimes you got to meet the kids where they're at. So I have come up with some ideas for video games, and I'm looking for people that want to help create video games. And maybe we can create video games that can help children in their educational process. Because right about now, we're losing a lot of kids in the education arena. You know, Dr. Stephen Perry is widely respected by grassroots community members and well-renowned leaders. Dr. Steve Perry's charismatic and compelling voice is an inspiration. He is the educator upon whom Oprah Winfrey, Sean P. Diddy Combs, Bishop T.D. Jakes, and Steve Harvey called to offer insight to parents and children. Capital Prep Charter School in Harlem is the first time many parents learned of Sean P. Diddy Combs and Dr. Perry creating a school for Black youth in Harlem. And so this is something that is legendary. It's historical. And I, once again, would like to thank Dr. Stephen Perry for even calling in and taking time out of his schedule to speak to us. If you have a product, a good, or a service that you want to promote on our radio program to receive also promotion on our podcast at anchor.fm/TheReallyRealTalk, where we are also on 8 platforms. So not only will your products, goods, and services be promoted here on blogtalkradio.com/HearNoEvil, you'll be on 8 different platforms, including Spotify. And when you commit to paying for your promotional products, you'll automatically receive free television exposure on Celebrity Showcase TV. So if you're interested, just go to literaryladiesbooktour.com and fill out the application, and you never know, you'll be on the program. I'm in a Marvin Gaye mood, so I realize that some of the things that's going on in the world today, he sang about in the 60s and 70s, so I'm going to play a little bit of his music. Listen in right now for Marvin Gaye on Mercy, Mercy. Enjoy.
The blue skies go. Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be gone. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas. Fish full of mercury. Underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby by our side. Oh, mercy, mercy, mercy. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from men? Can't you stand?
They don't make good music like that anymore. Thank you for tuning in to Hear No Evil on blogtalkradio.com. And if you'd like to call in the show, 516-453-9097. 516-453-9097. There's a lot going on. So let me tell you. I have created an app again. It's called the Wear app. And in probably another week, it'll be live on Google Play, in Google Play stores. And the Wear app is an app that contains information and directions of interstate highways in New York, parks, and basically tourism. This is like an app for tourists. Also, I decided to put a component of inventions on there because there are a lot of products that women have created that we use every day that we don't know that was created by women. So I put that on there. And how about this? One link will give you a list of great restaurants, and another link will give you great restaurants in Harlem. And I feel that because de Blasio has opened New York back up, a lot of you are going to want to know where the spots are. So we're giving you an opportunity to have that information one touch away, right on your phone. So if you're interested in receiving the test of the Wear app before it becomes live and on sale, you can reach out to Darlene Renee Lewis at DarleneRenee Lewis at yahoo.com, or you can just go to futurenetworkproductions.com and you can find out all about the inventions and everything that I'm doing. I'm also casting for the Aaliyah film called Back and Forth, produced by Stephen Sticks Josie. And I casted Eric Hayes Hagen, who is a writer, producer, rapper, and actor. Very talented guy. And Orange Juice Jones, you know, from I Saw You Walking in the Rain. Yeah, I casted him, his sons, and his daughter, Perry Jones, who is a singing sensation. So the Joneses will be in that movie as well, including the wife, maybe, Wendy Jones. So I was able to cast them. And shout out to Styx for allowing me to cast those individuals, because I also casted for a few other movies, like Have Plenty. I casted for Model Behavior and now Back and Forth. So I'm very happy about that, and I'm looking forward to that. Also, I want to let everybody know that the author, Gerald Quick, who wrote the book Three Sisters, and he now is managing a recording artist. You're going to be hearing a little bit about his recording artist soon. So I'm hoping that he's ready for this music world, because that music industry is something else, okay? And I'm looking forward to New York City opening back up and things becoming available to us, because for a long time I was getting like that bug, like, oh my God, there's no place to go where I feel safe. Like I'm sick of really walking around wearing a mask, and you know, I'm very afraid of, you know, really, really getting too comfortable as far as opening myself back up to being around a lot of people. I really don't want to risk that, but I'm going to do what I can to enjoy myself and not be paranoid about the city opening back up. As far as traveling, I can't wait to get back on the road with my Literary Ladies book tour. And if you are an author and you want to register right now, we are accepting authors right now. And we're doing a lot of virtual book tours. So get at me, literaryladiesbooktour.com. Right now, our latest author, Michelle Griffin Carter, she has a children's book out. She's about to do a book talk with Sisters Bookstore. So we're looking forward to that. I did one in February. And you can see that book talk on Celebrity Showcase TV, because I had to break it down in three parts. So you'll see that on Celebrity Showcase TV, on Spectrum TV. And if you missed it, then you can go to literaryladiesbooktour.com and click on podcast or TV, and you'll see the book talk that aired on Spectrum in three parts. It was really, really good. What else is going on? So I talked to you about the Literary Ladies Book Tour. I talked to you about, Hands That Make a Difference. Hands That Make a Difference is open for summer camp. So make sure you go to handsthatmakeadifference.org and register your kids for summer camp, because they're open. They got approved to open once again this summer. And that's going to be a great, great, great experience for kids. And at the end of the year, they always take the kids to Disney World. So that's always a lot of fun. And once again, I want to thank Steve Perry for calling in to blogtalkradio.com/hearnoevil. And that was a very interesting thing that he said. He mentioned that he reached out to the community. And, you know, maybe I'll get the CEO, Lisa Fields Lennon, maybe she needs to do a town hall meeting to let people know that Hands That Make a Difference is open for business, because we do get a lot of kids, and sometimes we don't have the funding to provide some of the things and services that we want to provide, because, you know, things cost a lot of money, and a lot of times that money is out of pocket. And but she's been able to survive for the last 10 years through hella hot water and through fundraisers and for donations. And thank God for individuals that have contributed, that believe in education and believe that the kids deserve a winning chance and believe that the children are our future. So let's see now. I'm in a mood for some more Marvin Gaye. Hope you are too.
Bills follow, sky high.
You know,
everybody thinks we're all the mother. Who are they to judge us? Mother, mother, simply call the sweet where I am. Oh, mother, mother.
Can never go wrong with Marvin Gaye. You can never, ever go wrong with Marvin Gaye. Marvin Gaye is a prophet. Everything that he's talking about happened and it's still happening. Trigger Happy Policeman. Mother's still crying. What are we going to do, people? I want to thank you guys for tuning in, and until next time. Love each other.
DJ, right? But I had to put that mix up in there. I'll talk to you guys later. Love you.
Hey, what's up, man?
Brother, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Recorded, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Right on.
there's too many of you to cry. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you die. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and tears here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on? What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? Oh, what's going on?
Right now. Right now.
Thank you.